This is the crisis point. Welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like G.K. Chesterton, we never discuss anything except politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am Michael Warren Davis, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. I am joined by my co-host, Philip Lawler. On today's show, we are going to discuss the Vatican finance scandal. We are going to discuss the continuing involvement of priests and bishops in anti-police Black Lives Matter protests across the country. Phil, I'm just going to ask you, what is going on with the Vatican finances and this property in London?
I wish I knew, but the only way we will ever know is if the Vatican gives us some information, and so far it's been very, very stingy on information. Here's what we know. We know that there was an investment made through the Secretariat of State using funds that were donated by the faithful in the Peter's Pence collection, among other things. The funds were invested in property in real estate in London. Clearly, an investment looking for a return has nothing to do with the mission of the church, which is okay. I mean, you want the investment to be used prudently. But all sorts of questions have been raised about how that money was invested. It was invested by people who were not authorized to invest money in the Secretariat of State. And apparently some people made exorbitant profits. Now, that's all I can tell you for sure. The next little tidbit of information that I can give you is last October, there was a raid on the offices, two offices in the Vatican, the office of the Secretariat of State and the offices of the Financial Information Authority, known as AIF. After those raids, several people were suspended. The names of the people who were suspended were not made public officially. They leaked out. When they were leaked out, the head of the Vatican police force resigned under pressure, because that was the source of the leak. This past week, we had the Vatican prosecutor announce the arrest of one individual, Gianluigi Torsi, a lay Italian financier, who is charged with all sorts of fraud and manipulation in connection with this, and apparently making exorbitant fees on the exchange. That's about all we know. So the rest we're trying to read tea leaves.
So the Vatican links up with this sketchy financier, Gianluigi Torsi. Somehow, someone in the Secretariat of State presumably meets with this guy who they've run into at some dingy nightclub in Rome, and they get them to invest a substantial amount of money in Chelsea, the neighborhood of Chelsea in London, which is a very upmarket neighborhood in a country that is a couple hundred miles away from Vatican City. And as you said, theoretically, there's nothing wrong with wanting a good return on a property investment. But what triggered this alert was that he had requested upwards of over $100 million from the Vatican to invest in property. I think a lot of people are just going to be surprised to know that the Vatican deals in this high level of real estate, as you say, just for profit. And of course, the church having money, theoretically, a good thing. They can do lots of charitable work. But there is apparently this entire appendage of the Curia that is devoted solely to raising currency for Vatican projects. And we don't know anything about it. And when there is apparently massive institutional corruption, we won't even be told the names of the people who are ferreted out and dismissed. Wasn't one of the priests who was involved in the raids on the Secretariat of State, didn't he end up living in the same building? He was moved to the same building that the Pope lives in?
That may be. I don't know that, but you might very well be right. I don't know.
So is this pretty much the same as in the United States? Is there basically a money class in the Vatican that pretty much pull the strings and have total immunity and can fire the head of the Vatican gendarme when they feel like it?
Simple answer, I think, is yes. And that would be the Secretary of State. Now, you said that there is, let me just correct you on one thing, where you said that there is a group of people in the Vatican who control these huge investments. On paper, that's not the case. On paper, these people are not authorized. The Secretary of State is not authorized to make multi-million-dollar investments, but they did.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that that's fraud. I'm just saying that they acted on their own initiative. And, you know, yes, it's a good thing to have the funds invested to bring a return rather than just sitting there in a bank account. On the other hand, these are funds that were contributed by people who thought they were going to the good works of the Holy Father. They didn't think that they were going to purchase real estate in London. And if as you're writing a check, you think it's going to purchase real estate in London, that might affect the size of the check you write.
Of course.
Or how happy you are to find out about what's being done with your money.
I'm not too keen to line Gianluigi Torsi's pockets or really anyone like him. Not the sort of people that I would ever do business with. And so I'm really quite shocked to hear that. Well, that's the next question. So, Phil, do you think that Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, had any involvement? I know that, I mean, we probably can't say for sure, but could this have gone on in his department without his knowledge?
No, he signed off on it, I feel sure. Whether he paid much attention to what he was signing off on, I can't say. He's a very busy man. I think it would have crossed his desk. But if his chief lieutenant says, here, we need your signature, I don't think he would have spent much time on it. The more interesting question to me is Cardinal Becciu, who is now the prefect of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. But back then, he was the sustituto. It was his office that was making these arrangements.
Wow. When was he moved?
Oh, was it? I'd have to look that up. It's maybe a couple of years ago. He has said that he doesn't know Torsi, that Torsi came on the scene after he, Cardinal Becciu, had left the office. So that might suggest that he's been gone longer than I think. Mm. But he was the one who originally got the Vatican involved in this deal. And so he's definitely under fire. He is now saying that Torsi acted completely by himself, but Torsi couldn't have acted completely by himself if somebody from the Vatican hadn't pulled the trigger to get the Vatican involved in the first place.
Yeah, he's using Vatican money. unless he robbed the Vatican Bank, someone's involved. He's not acting on his own.
Two things, as a matter of fact. You mentioned the Vatican Bank, and the Vatican Bank has had a rough history in the last 20 years or so. I'm happy to say the Vatican Bank is not involved in this at all. The Vatican Bank, as far as I can see, is clear of this completely. On the other hand, some other banks were involved, some Swiss banks, and it's very interesting that the Vatican prosecutor made a request to Swiss banking authorities for information about a couple of the banks that were involved in this deal, furnishing funding. One of them was a problem bank, which had been closed because of multiple violations of money laundering statutes and whatnot. The accounts in those Swiss banks are now frozen at the Vatican's request. So it's really messy. There are obviously some if not criminal activities, at least shady, at least, you know, fast and loose activities going on. And somehow the Vatican has been involved. And I don't know the degree of whether it's complicity or stupidity or, you know, rapacity. As we were saying before we went on the air, I strongly suspect that what happens here is there are fast operators, and they see a sucker pool. And then there are individuals at the Vatican who think they're smarter than they are.
That seems to be the case also with Cardinal Parolin's dealings with China. He seems to think that he can get the upper hand on the vast Chinese communist bureaucracy and hoodwink them into securing rights for the church, as if the Vatican's tiny diplomatic corps could outfox the Communist Party of China. I think you're right. Yeah, I think that there is a great deal of a superabundance of men who overestimate their own intelligence in the Vatican. But I mean,
particularly in financial matters, I don't know if I've ever told you the first rule of playing poker. Hmm. First rule of playing poker is 15 minutes after you sit down at the table, identify the sucker in the room. If you can't identify the sucker, get up. You're the sucker.
I like that. Well, you brought up the Vatican Bank, and there were rumors abounding that the reason that Cardinal Pell's grossly illegitimate prosecution in Australia was connected to his valorous efforts to clean up the Vatican Bank. I've heard whispers, as I'm sure you have, that there is a connection between these investment properties in London and Cardinal Pell's dealings in the Vatican Bank. Do you, in the sense that Cardinal Pell might have gotten whiff of this impropriety and someone was trying to shut him up, do you think that there's any legitimacy to those rumors?
Well, again, I don't think it's a Vatican Bank. I think in this case, it's the Secretariat of State and the Office of the Administration of the Patrimony of the Holy See that were targets of Cardinal Pell's investigation. Mm-hmm. But with that proviso, I think you're right on target. I think it's a matter pretty much of public record that when Cardinal Pell wanted an outside audit of all the Vatican offices, it was the Secretariat of State and APSA, the Administration of the Patrimony of the Holy See, that objected and thwarted his bid for an audit. And, you know, an audit, an outside independent audit would have cured a lot of ills then. Just, was it last week or the week before that Pope Francis instituted some new guidelines for purchasing and for contracts at the Vatican? And those, the new rules are really a vindication of Cardinal Pell in that they're looking for, documenting each step, having a list of approved contractors so that you can't have these sweetheart deals, these no-bid contracts, the traditional old boy backdoor handshake deals that have cost a lot of money and also a lot of grief. And that was on the purchasing side. On the investment side, they need the same sort of thing. It's legitimate for the Vatican to invest what money it has, but it has to be done with discretion and accountability and professionalism, and it just isn't.
Yeah, it has to be above board. You talk about the old boy deals, and this has probably been going on in Rome for 1,000 years, these connections between, the princes of the church inside the walls of the Vatican and then the seedy criminal underbelly of Italy, sort of cowering beneath the walls and the shadows, which is another interesting point. There has, ever since this news of this scandal broke and since the Secretariat of State was raided, there have been rumors that the Vatican was involved with the mafia or some organized crime faction in Italy. Do you think Gianluigi Torsi is mafia or is connected to the mafia, or does the mafia have any involvement in this?
I have no evidence of that, but it is a question I'm pursuing.
Okay.
How's that?
Absolutely. Well, I hope that we hear it, if not first here, then we'll hear it second here. So that's very, I'm curious about that too. And that has to come out at some point, not because the Vatican is necessarily going to be forthcoming, which of course they're not forthcoming about anything, but because if, say some C-list mob boss that was handling, for instance, let's say Gianluigi Torsi is mafia, some C-list mob boss in Naples, say, who's sort of in charge, his overboss, he's in charge of Torsi. He gets busted, and all of a sudden there's this paper trail going back to the Vatican. Are the Italian police going to cover the Vatican's rear? Probably not. So this has to make the Vatican sweat, because unlike with Cardinal McCarrick, where the paper trail was in the nuncature in Washington and in Rome, there is an external paper trail for this scandal. And you'll never crack those Swiss banks, but I'm sure you can crack some of the guys that worked in between. You might even be able to crack Gianluigi Torsi.
That's right. There's enough money on the table so that unsavory characters would certainly be interested in it. That much is obvious. Mm. And, you know, another point, speculation about the mafia is one thing. Even if it's not that bad, there's also something that I think is a historic reality that needs to change. And that is that people in the Vatican have, whether it's family connections or just traditional connections, oh, our office has always done business with so-and-so. Mm. And, you know, that's, well, let's face it, that's the way lots of us do business. Sure. In our everyday life. But there comes a point where you have to say, well, wait a minute. You've always done business with this family, with this contractor, with this supplier, but is there someone else who can provide the same service or the same goods at a considerable savings? You really should be investigating that possibility.
Or should you even be doing this kind of business to begin
with?
I would love to think that the Vatican has been doing business with the Torsi family for generations, and that they're old pals. So you also mentioned this, the AIF, the Financial Information Authority. What role do they play in all of this?
That's a fascinating question. As I said, in October, there was the raid, and the offices of the AIF and the offices of the Secretary of State were busted by the Vatican gendarmes, and some documents and some computer files were seized. The Secretary of State, we sort of know what was going on there. They were looking for information about this transaction. But what was happening at the AIF? Now, the AIF was set up as a watchdog agency. It was set up to ensure accountability on financial investigations. And it has been, it's seen a huge amount of turnover. And the people who have left have almost uniformly left saying that they were forced out because they wanted more information and the other Vatican officials didn't want to supply that information. Mm. To make a long story short, my question is this. Was the raid on the AIF done to find out whether the AIF was involved in this real estate transfer? Or was it done because the AIF was already investigating this transfer and somebody at the Vatican wanted to cover up the information that AIF was uncovering? In other words, was the bust on AIF done because they were complicit in the crime, if there was a crime, which it looks like there was, or was it because the AIF was getting too close to solving the crime?
I would love to know that. And the question, I guess, that poses is, will we ever really, is there any guarantee that we'll ever know? Because the liberties of the church, important as they are, also mean that the Vatican City State, being a sovereign state, has its own laws and its own law enforcement. Right. And though it doesn't really work this way in practice all the time, technically the Pope wields total temporal authority in the Holy See, as he does spiritual authority. So if Pope Francis or someone that he trusts doesn't want this scandal to come out, I don't think anyone's going to appeal to the United Nations and get a declaration of war or something. So short of that, is there anything that we can do? Is there any way that the truth will out unless we're relying solely on the honesty and transparency of the Roman Curia?
Short answer, no.
There you go.
The longer answer is there are ways to exert pressure. And one way you exert pressure to ensure that people handle money accountably is you stop giving them money until they prove that they're trustworthy.
Phil, we touched on this topic last week, and that is the bishops and some in the priests, but particularly the bishops' involvement in the Black Lives Matter, Antifa, George Floyd protests, demonstrations, riots that have been taking place all across the United States. And so I noticed, so you and I had an email exchange about this, and I said that Black Lives Matter is an anti-police organization. I don't mean that in a rhetorical sense. I mean that they don't believe that police departments should exist. This is something that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that it was the leaders of Black Lives Matter that started the defund the police movement. They are the ones that successfully lobbied for the Minneapolis City Council to abolish and dismantle its police department. And so, yes, I mean, the Black Lives Matter is a fundamentally anti-police institution. And so for the moment, let's set aside the fact that all of the bishops have rushed to embrace the false narrative that George Floyd's death was the result of systemic racism in law enforcement. Because you and I know that there was no evidence whatsoever that Officer Derek Chauvin acted out of racial animus. Just as there's no evidence that Freddie Gray was killed by those six police officers out of any racial animus. We know that if only because three of the officers that were charged with his death were themselves Black. So let's set the dubious nature of the narrative aside. Why are these priests and bishops, and particularly the bishops, why are they aligning with this far left, hardcore, fundamentally, philosophically anti-police organization like Black Lives Matter, which is aligned very closely with Antifa, which is either has been or is going to be declared a terrorist organization, and is in fact a group of Maoist and anarchist militants who are seeking to literally destroy the civil order and bring down the U.S. government. Are the bishops really that left wing, or are they dupes, or are they just chasing popularity? Do they just want the pat on the back and the retweet from all the hip, cool millennial activists?
I couldn't tell you. I think it's a combination of all of the above. I think the narrative fits more closely with their political sympathies with most of the bishops. I think there's a fear factor, and I think there is a desire for public approbation. What I find particularly distressing is the number of bishops who have encouraged public demonstrations. To my knowledge, none of the bishops have encouraged violence, but they have encouraged the demonstrations at a time when some of them are discouraging people from assembling for the holy sacrifice of the Mass. Most notably in Washington, where Archbishop Gregory still has not opened his churches, nor has he protested publicly the limitation that restricts religious gatherings to 10 people, including the priest, which is nothing in a big church. It's ridiculous. But he encouraged all of his priests to show up for the demonstrations in Washington, making a point that they should wear clerical attire to make sure that they're recognized. I find that the double standard is so evident that it's hard to understand how he can look at himself in the mirror, frankly.
The Jesuits made the same point in the in America magazine. They were lamenting the fact that, unlike during the civil rights movement in the 1960s, there was a paucity of visible nuns and priests in the ranks of the George Floyd protesters. And of course, a lot of those priests and nuns who participated in the civil rights movement themselves ended up leaving the priesthood and abandoned or the convent and abandoned their vocation. Not that the civil rights movement was wrong by any means, but a lot of these activist clergy and religious, they do, historically, they end up leaving the priesthood. And it doesn't really come as much surprise because, as you just pointed out, this ruling regime in the church prioritizes physical welfare over spiritual welfare. And they seem more concerned with the cause of social justice than they are with the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass seems to be this thing that kind of happens in the background of the life of the church, and it's good, and you need to do it, and you get grace and things like that. But you do it at 7 a.m., and then on Sundays, and then if you're a priest, you do it every day if you feel like it. But the real business of the church, or the conscious effort of the church has to be, it seems, these bishops and priests and religious seem to think, has to be on promoting the social gospel, social welfare, social justice. And the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass is not so important that if you're going to catch the coronavirus, we can just shut down Mass. It's not actually that necessary. So is that right, Phil?
It's not right. And I think you'll see further, I don't want to say a split, but it's close to a split within the church between the people who are most interested in the social gospel to the exclusion of the sacramental life of the church and those of us who for the last few months have been hungering for the sacraments and frustrated with the attention that our pastors and bishops in many cases are giving to all manner of public issues other than whether we're given access to the sacraments. So the net result, I think, is a lot of faithful lay Catholics find themselves even more hungry for the sacraments and even more intensely devoted to the spiritual life of the church and more likely to follow those priests and bishops who have been speaking their language in the last few months.
When I was a younger man and an Episcopalian, I was one of the only young active members of my local parish. Now, I went to the Church of the Advent in Boston most of the time, but we had a local Episcopal church that I would go to. And I was asked to join the vestry. And at the first vestry meeting, they said, well, what do you think that we should do to bring in young people? I said, first of all, take down the rainbow flag. Second of all, stop preaching social justice from the pulpit. Because if people want social justice and left-wing politics, they'll go to the Democratic Party. That's what it exists for. Young families who are interested in going to church are going to church because they want church. They want Christianity. They want scriptures. They want the traditions of the church. They want to hear pro-family messages. Because, I mean, again, these young left-wing active, the logic seems to be, and you do see it all over the Episcopal Church, they're absolutely desperate for some sort of quote unquote relevance, right? And they think that if they can jive with what the kids like, you know, gay pride, pro-choice, female ministers, gender fluid, this and that, then they will be able to save themselves from their rapidly diminishing membership. But if you're the kind of person that's into gender fluid, whatever, you know, if all you believe in is sex, drugs, and rock and roll, why are you going to get up early on a Sunday morning to go to church to hear about sex, drugs, and rock and roll? It's insane. And, you know, that's, but that seems to be the direction that a lot of the Catholic Church is going in too.
Well, it is, but it's a direction that I don't think is going to sustain itself. I think that, just as you say, the people who have that interest, you know, an earlier generation stayed in bed Sunday to watch the talk shows, Meet the Press and Face the Nation. And I never did. I don't know if they're still on or not. But I think the equivalent is still happening, that you can easily get what you want. If what you want is social justice and cries for political reform, you can get those anywhere. And frankly, what you get in the Catholic Church is not the 86 proof stuff. So if you really want it, you'll find it elsewhere. And meanwhile, those of us who want the sacramental life of the church, we're going to find our ways to get it. We're going to find the places, the parishes, the pastors, the bishops who provide it. And there's the future of the church.
It is terribly sad, and I try not to take too much schadenfreude from it. But I see the Episcopal Church of my youth, and as their congregations get grayer and grayer, and as their members get older and older and die off, they still double down on the relevance model. You're hard pressed to find a male priest in the Episcopal Church anymore. And every single Episcopal Church you see has a rainbow flag outside now. It's inescapable, and it's not working. The Episcopal Church and all of these mainline Protestant churches are hemorrhaging members. And where are they going? A lot of them are going to evangelical churches. That's absolutely true. But a whole ton of them are going to the Catholic Church. But they're not going to these social justice parishes. They're going to the very traditional parishes, especially the traditional Latin Mass parishes. And if this was purely, let's set aside all matter of principle. If this was purely a question of how to retain members, of how to keep the most people in the church, then the answer, ironically, is to be irrelevant, is to not chase relevance, to stand against the culture, and to say this is a place where you are safe to profess the traditional Christian Catholic faith. Your family is welcome here. Your children are welcome here. There's no little old lady that's going to tut-tut because you're interrupting her nice Sunday service with your 10 kids crying. The more kids you bring in, the merrier. And that is the model that where the church is going to succeed going forward. It is not this cloying, desperate, pathetic attempt to get in with the cool young activist class. There's a tiny portion of the church, the bishops and the priests and the laity, who seem to get that. There's a tiny portion that's going to double down on the social justice agenda, and then there's a lot of people stuck in the middle that are kind of confused. So all we have to do is to keep doing what we're doing, to stand by the traditional faith, to support good priests and bishops, and to refuse anything that claims that it's going to make the church relevant, because the church is always relevant. The church is always timely because she is timeless. That is all the time that we have for this week. Thank you so much for joining me, Phil, and thank you all for tuning in. We look forward to speaking with you again next Friday. Until then, I am Michael Warren Davis. He is Philip F. Lawler, and this is the Crisis Point Podcast. Thank you again, and God bless you all.